Hi there, and welcome to another CaperCast. This is Jim Brown. I find it hard to believe, but this is issue number 3. And I have a little news for you that will form a lead-in to my story about how my son Stephen and I had a chance to work out in a very remote Polynesian atoll island. It's another survival story. Everyone is interested in survival because we're all trying to survive. I heard a little news this morning. It's not new news because it started down in the Caribbean last November when a big catamaran, 57-footer, was capsized. People got off okay, but the boat was abandoned. This morning I learned that it had recently shown up outside of Cape Lookout, North Carolina. It had been drifting for all those months. It was floating high and happy. Some fishermen came across it, towed it in, got it right side up, pressure washed it off. The thing is apparently salvageable after 6 months at sea. Now, there was no one aboard, but if there had been, it would probably have been habitable if they had had adequate stores that were not lost in the capsize or shortly afterwards. They probably could have survived for 6 months, and that would have beaten, by 2 months, the record of true survival by John Glennie and his crew, who actually did spend 4 months aboard John's beautiful trimaran Rose Noel, a 40-footer, upside down and drifting around in the Southern Ocean down there off of New Zealand for 119 days. I'm not here to say they had an easy time of it. All you have to do is read John's book to know that he and his two crewmen had a hell of a time of it. But when they finally drifted ashore back in New Zealand, they were in such good physical condition that the authorities did not believe that they could possibly have been castaways for 4 months. Now, there are several other incidents on record of multi-hulls being either capsized or abandoned upright during storms and discovered months or even years later. The point is that these boats just don't go away, and that relates to the story I mentioned last time where these guys at Fast Forward Composites up in Bristol, Rhode Island definitely are embarked upon a program to arrange for their new 53-foot catamaran now under construction and to be fitted with a hybrid wing sail. Because of the buoyancy of the hybrid wing, if it survives the capsize, it will not allow the vessel to turn turtle. It would lie on its side, one hull on the surface, or if it were to downflood, it would probably submerge part way, but that would still permit the crew to inhabit the upper hull for who knows how long. They'd be dry and relatively comfortable compared to gutsing it out in a life raft. Now, I don't know if this Bristol group is intending to arrange for rewriting automatically, but I wouldn't be surprised because they're attempting to arrange for everything else about the vessel to be automatic, particularly pilot assist using radar flight control when hydrofoiling. We know that self-rescue from a knockdown position, not a turn turtle position, but from a knockdown, mast and sails in the water, that has been arranged, particularly in Jan Goujon's Goujon 32 catamaran. There have been several capsizes, both in practice and in anger, with a very successful onboard recovery, but it's not automatic. The sailor has to get out there and crank wrenches and put up a little gin pole and get the boat back on its feet that way. But there's no reason why that cannot be done automatically if the technology and the money is available. And of course, if that can be accomplished, it would be a tremendous advance because we'd have our multi-hull vessels could potentially be not only unsinkable, but self-rescuing from a knockdown position.
Hey you, Tiger, where are you going with this anyway? How does all of that survival stuff relate to the remote Pacific Atoll? Don't you want to start over?
Oh, Christy, give me a chance for Pete's sake. You've been behaving yourself. All of that is preamble to our arrival, my son Stephen and I, arriving at Funafuti Atoll, right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, just west of the dateline and just south of the equator, one of the truly forgotten corners of the Earth. That is, until recently, when rising sea levels have caused this mid-Pacific island nation to become uninhabitable. A group of 8 atolls called Tuvalu, T-U-V-A-L-U, formerly part of the British colony called Gilbert Ellice Islands, and when given their independence, they split off from the Gilbert, who are Micronesians, and set up their own country in the Ellice group because they are Polynesians. And Stephen and I had a chance to go out there and work for a while doing something fundamentally ridiculous, which was to teach Polynesians how to build outrigger canoes. I'm sure I must have spoken of this caper before. It was the third of 4 or 5 projects I had in the 1980s in what in the poverty business they call community development. The idea is to try to keep small hamlets, little villages in the developing world, economically viable so that the people are not forced to move to the cities, the so-called centralization phenomenon. They've barely stemmed the tide. All over the world, provincial people are flooding into the cities in order to find opportunity. And in the case of Tuvalu, it started back in the 1970s when people from the outer islands, of which there are 8, from 60 to 200 miles apart, scattered out across the Pacific like a pinch of pepper thrown across the kitchen floor. So many of the people from the outer islands had moved to Funafuti, which is the district center, the largest of the 8 atolls. And this one is blessed or cursed with a landing strip. And that landing strip is, of course, left over from World War II. Maybe some of you will remember the Great Battle of Tarawa. It is a much larger atoll up in the Gilbert group, and the Japanese had developed it as a real stronghold in their march across the Pacific Islands. And the Allies just had to assault this place, I think it was in 1944, and Funafuti was the only mere scrap of land within bombing range of Tarawa. They had to put in an airstrip at Funafuti. So imagine this place before the war, almost a grass shack, almost a grass skirt society, that had been modified by mostly the London Missionary Society and nothing more. It's composed of a lagoon about 5 miles by 10 miles, a private lake out in the middle of the Pacific surrounded by coral islets. Now, for anyone that doesn't know about atolls, I should explain that what they are is former mountain tops that have subsided, sunken down below the surface of the sea, usually volcanic, and as they sink slowly, the coral reef around the shore of the full-blown island keeps growing and builds up a ring that has in its middle an old volcano crater. They are geologically very interesting, and Funafuti was used back in the 1920s as the place to drill down through the island as deep as possible to see if it was composed of coral all the way. The wellhead is still there, marked with a commemorative plaque, and they found coral down, I think, more than 2,000 feet, and the place, that experiment was used to prove Darwin's theory about the formation of atolls. Of course, we're talking geological time here, and what happens is that great storms tend to throw fragments of the reef up onto itself, thereby building an island. Or in this case, a ring of little islands surrounding the lagoon. The main islet is about 1/2 mile wide in the widest place and about 2 miles long, arranged around the lagoon. And when Stephen and I were there, there were about 2,000 people living on that scrap, half a mile by 2 miles. I've heard that since then there have been as many as 8,000 people living on that scrap, that mere smear of solid stuff emerging from the surface of the sea. And believe me, all it is crushed coral rock and coconuts. There's no way the people could survive on that bit of real estate without the heavy presence of foreign aid. Because it's a former British colony, of course, the British presence is there. Also, Australian and New Zealand presence. The American presence was represented by Save the Children, which from my experience was a red-hot outfit with inspired development planning. So the director of Save the Children in Tuvalu was an American guy named Jack Locke, and he realized that these people needed boats. Most of the families on the main islet owned property on the outer islets, but they couldn't get there anymore with a boat that was big enough to bring anything back. Their traditional marine architecture involved building the main hull of their proas out of a solid log dugout, and they had exhausted the supply of big trees for big logs for making big canoes. All they had left was 1 or 2 man canoes. So it was Jack Lockett that realized that they had to have some other way of building their canoes besides the solid log dugout method. And, of course, that's how Stephen and I got into the act. I had previously been working for my Philippine client at Cebu, where we had set up a small manufacturing outfit for constant camber panels. These are big slabs of compound curved plywood made with wood and epoxy, and each slab represented one half of a pea pod that was 32 feet long, and if you had 2 pea pods, you could put them together to make a 32-foot-long canoe. So we shipped a bunch of those panels out to Tuvalu, and Stephen and I went out there to show the guys how to put them together. I think it was about 1983 or 4 when we went. I had been there the year before on a so-called needs assessment program, try to arrange to get materials in there and fix us up a place to work. Jack built us a big lean-to off the side of the fisheries shed, right on the lagoon. And the materials, which included a drum of epoxy and a pallet full of supplies, had been shipped out there by the little ship that belongs to the island group, the venerable Nivanga, which was a total rust bucket. Managed to get all our stuff out there, so here Stephen and I came in a little airplane flying up from Fiji, 600 miles of nothing but open ocean, in a small twin-engine flying pickup truck absolutely crammed with the pilot, me and Steve, and the back of it crammed to the ceiling with our tools and more supplies. Now, of course, I had been there before, but as we approached the atoll, I sort of knew what it was going to look like. We were only up about 2,000 feet. I pointed ahead so that Steve could see this mere smear of something else on the surface of the sea. I shouted to him, "That's where we're going." He gaped out the window, slapped himself in the forehead, slumped down in the seat. We were there together only for 3 months, but they asked him to stay on after our initial project. He was there for a couple of years. Joanna and I had the chance to go together. We ended up with family out there. It was certainly a seminal experience in the lives of all of us. So here we come in for a landing on this grass strip that was built in 1944, and this is how it was built. One morning, the islanders woke up to find their lagoon filled with American warships. A delegation came ashore to meet with the local traditional leadership. They explained that the Japanese were coming. Now, of course, the people had heard all kinds of bad things about how the Japanese were treating the islanders. And the Americans said, we've got to build an airstrip to hold them off. So the local chiefs and judges sat around in their maniapa, a big thatched meeting house, grass mats on the floor, and came out with the decision, well, okay, if the Japanese are coming, you better build an airstrip. Well, 4 days and 9 hours later, B-25s were landing. If you can imagine the shock to the islanders. And to build that strip, the Seabees had to bring in bulldozers and drag lines and just rip the dickens out of the island in order to get enough material to elevate the strip above the sea so that it was usable in all weather. A great part of the island's dry land was simply ripped off, including all the sand from the beaches on the lagoon side. They said, oh, it'll come back. Well, it never has. And when we were there, the islanders had even run out of room to bury people. The new graves were dug into the bones of the ancestors. But that airstrip was crucial in the assault on Tarawa. It was a terrible battle. But as Steve and I landed and stepped out of the airplane, we heard music coming out of the village, drums and all kinds of action, and they explained to us that it was a local holiday. It was Bomb Day. They were celebrating the day when one Japanese airplane was able to drop one bomb on the Funafuti airstrip. And of course, bomb craters are easily fixed and patched. Anyway, we got going fixing up our constant camber canoe building operation with our five local trainees. Ended up making indelible friends with guys like Ofati and Menga and Paletti, and especially Levi Tapu, who turned out to be our principal trainee and a great friend of Stevens. Anyway, we'd been there for a while when we met one of the two guys that they said had returned from the dead. It took us a while to figure out what was going on, and I never really did get the straight story. But it seems these two guys had gone fishing one night in their outboard-powered aluminum skiff, a rare thing there at the time. They had gone outside the lagoon to troll around the reef in the deep drop-off water, trying to catch skipjack tuna. And in the process, they had gotten around to the lee side of the island, and their motor quit. Of course, they tried and tried to get it started without success, and they were drifting away from the island. Now, of course, their local canoes can be paddled and sailed, but an aluminum skiff with a dead outboard motor? Pretty hard to move it anywhere, especially against the wind in the open Pacific. So off they went into oblivion. Now, I don't remember the details, but these guys were gone for months, long enough for their families to conduct their funerals. But here is how they survived. They had fishing tackle, right? So they weren't going to starve. I mean, here are Polynesians. They were going to be able to get enough moisture out of the fish food in order to stay alive. But after a few days, they realized that what was killing them was the sun. So they did a very Polynesian thing. They took the motor off and dumped it overboard. And in the daylight hours, they would turn the canoe over and get under it in the water. They had to kick the sharks out of the way. Sometimes the sharks would zoom in and take away their fish. But most sharks won't bother anything that shows the slightest ability to defend itself, because if they become injured, of course, they become meat for their fellows. So along about late afternoon, they would turn the canoe back right side up, bail it out, get in, and spend the night. And anything adrift tends to act as what they call a fag, a fish aggregating device. Maybe it's the shade that attracts little fish, and that attracts bigger fish, etc., so they were able to feed themselves. And I can't remember where they washed up, but They came back to Funafuti just before Stephen and I arrived. And we were told that the local people said, "Oh, I thought you were dead." But these guys were able to slide right back into their grass shack, grass skirt society, be completely at home. And incidentally, that's often the case with people who leave the islands today. They can go and work in other countries or on ships. As a matter of fact, when we were there, there were two schools, one for training the men as merchant seamen, where they were highly valued because of their integrity, and one for training nurses to work in other countries. And very often these expatriates would be away for years and come back and slide right back into their home environment with barely a ripple, very little consequence of having been exposed to the outside
world.
Well, our boat building project was fairly successful there, at least for a while. We were told that what they really needed was a canoe that could carry 300 coconuts. So our first vessel was a 32-foot proa, and Stephen was able to teach sail making. We got a bunch of sailcloth donated and a couple of sewing machines, and he sat around for days in the Maneapa with sewing machines and the local women teaching sail making, which is something he had a bit of experience with. And they put this 300-nut canoe to work around the lagoon, bringing stuff in from the outer islets. And the next thing we knew, they needed a 500-nut canoe. So we put together two 32-foot hulls in a catamaran, which incidentally was the first of our constant camber catamaran workboats. And when Joanna and I went back out there 2 years later, here came the catamaran loaded down with people and stuff to the point where it was almost dragging its underwing. The thing was definitely seeing heavy service. That thing made a circuit of the lagoon every day, stopping at all the islets, and the deal was that anybody could ride for any part of the route for a dollar, and for one more dollar they could bring aboard anything they could carry. And after I left, the project began building canoes for other islands and even other countries in the Pacific. And the next thing we knew, this business, which was intended as a bootstrap community development project, went into profit. And that, dear friends, was its downfall. After I left and Stephen left and Jack Lockett left, but money was coming in, all of a sudden there's a big to-do about who gets to keep the money. The local government gets in the act. They fail to order new materials, fail to pay the workers, and the project eventually folded. The same damn thing happened to my project in Burundi in East Africa. But that was not the end of our bad luck in Tuvalu. When we were there, British Aid had provided a flying boat service. There was otherwise no communication between these far-flung atolls. So they had a beautiful Grumman Widgeon and two pilots to operate the thing and a nice hangar, so you could actually fly from one island to the other. But after a while, the British realized that the flying boat service, under those conditions, extremely harsh conditions, was terribly expensive, so they withdrew the flying boat service, and all of a sudden the local government and Save the Children had no means of traveling between the islands. So Jack Lockett came to me one day and said, "I realize that we have success with the 32-footers for intra-lagoon transport. Now what we need is a catamaran big enough to sail between the islands." Again, these are voyages of from 60 to 200 miles that separate these atolls. So I was commissioned to design a 48-foot constant camber catamaran. We did not have the facilities to build it in Tuvalu, so we arranged for the constant camber panels again to be produced in the Philippines. Now, these things were big, We had them shipped to Hawaii, where our friend Tim Mann was in a position to put them together into a seafaring catamaran. And from Hawaii, the boat was to be sailed on its own bottom down to Funafuti. Well, we soon heard from Tim Mann that he had discovered that the constant camber panels were of unacceptable quality. Lots of voids between their layers. We struggled with trying to repair them, but finally had to abandon the project and Save the Children took a tremendous hit. I was absolutely sick about it, and still am. I think if we had made a success out of that project in that setting, that it would have caught on and perpetuated itself throughout the remote Pacific Islands. There's no doubt that the boats could have done the job, because the same sort of boat, almost the same design, is now operating. I think John Marples and I have something over 30 constant camber catamarans operating as excursion boats, as so-called catamarans, as we call them, and they will sustain heavy service for long periods. The U.S. Coast Guard loves them for certifying for carrying passengers for hire. But nowadays, the funding for such experimental development projects has dried up, and the technology has moved on, particularly in the case of fast-forward composites, the stories I've been telling in previous podcasts. But still, constant camber boats are being built. In fact, our friend Doug Jane has started on vessel number 8. He's built 8 of these catamarans, and the builder can make money on them, and the operator, if he can get it in a good location, can really make money on it. So there's no doubt that there are opportunities in the remote portions of the world for wind-propelled human transportation across the water. And of course, some destinations, like Tuvalu, for instance, are going away. Most of the people are leaving in order to take up residence in New Zealand. Thank God New Zealand has opened its arm to the Pacific Islanders that are being driven out by rising sea levels now. Of course, it's not just that the oceans are rising, it's that in places the land is subsiding. That's true in Tuvalu. It's also true where I live here in Tidewater, Virginia. Not far from here is the largest concentration of military might on the planet, the Norfolk Navy Yard and Battleship Row, and the Navy is now proceeding with elevating all of its piers and facilities. And some areas of downtown Norfolk and the other cities around the world's greatest harbor are underwater during very high tides. And the climatology is pretty clear. If the Arctic ice cap continues to melt at its present rate, and there is no indication that it will slow down, every indication that it will speed up, it is quite possible, apparently, that sea level could rise as much as 20 feet within this century. It seems that all we can do is hope that that won't happen, because the results could be truly cataclysmic for humanity. But the naked ape has proven itself to be fantastically resilient and adaptable to changes in its environment. And it sure looks to me like one of those adaptations would have to be to utilize modern seafaring technology in order to capture the power of the wind for overwater transportation. If only those poor guys in their aluminum skiff with a dead outboard motor had been able to paddle it or sail it home, they would have been doing almost exactly what humanity may have to do in the future. And nowadays we know so much more about the design, construction, the operation, and the ultimate safety of these modern lightweight seafaring multihulls. I mean, unsinkable and self-rescuing? Come on, we're going to have to know a lot about this stuff in the future, and for reasons far removed from sport and tourism. At least that's my opinion. And if any of our listeners has a relative opinion, please let us know about it. Let's talk about it here on Jim Brown's Outrigged Capercast. Okay, fair winds. Bye-bye.